Blog Talk Radio.
No weapon formed against me shall prosper.
I'm your host, Dr. Weldon McWilliams, and today our guest is Hampton University's very own Dr. Earl Williams. Are you with us, Dr. Williams?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. I can hear you. How are you this evening?
I am wonderful.
Thank you, and I just want to, again, extend the thanks for you taking time out of your busy schedule and telling us a little bit about yourself and your story, so thank you for that.
Okay, well, you're very welcome.
And just to start the interview, I know you're a clinical psychologist. If you could just tell us and the listening audience a little bit about yourself and how you got into the field of psychology.
Okay, well, I am a forensic clinical psychologist and a professor and an author. And it was a kind of a relatively circuitous route that brought me to psychology. I was a plumber, actually, and I participated in an affirmative action program while I was living in Boston, and was given admission to the Massachusetts College of Pharmacy. And while I was there, I took a couple of sociology courses, and that got me interested in human development. After 2 years at the College of Pharmacy, I enrolled in Roxbury Community College in Boston, and that's where I pursued courses in psychology. And my reason for getting into psychology courses was not really because I was interested in becoming a psychologist. I was really more interested in trying to figure out why I do some of the things that I do.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, it evolved into me becoming graduated from the University of Massachusetts, which I transferred to from Roxbury Community College. And a year later, I graduated with a BA in psychology, and I had heard about a brand new concept in psychology that was coming along. It was brand new at the time, and it was called a PsyD. So instead of getting a PhD, which is really a degree that is designed for people that are interested in becoming either academians or researchers, they had this PsyD, which was designed for people that want to be practitioners. And so my interest in psychology grew from trying to figure out why I do some of the things I do, to then wanting to become a psychologist and treat other people so to help them figure out why they do the things that they do. And so I enrolled in the School of Massachusetts School of Professional Psychology in the first year that they were active, I wrote that out, and it did take me quite a while to get through. It took me 7 years to get through a four-year program because at that time they didn't have any scholarships available, and I had a wife and child, and so there were times when I would have to drop out and work And there were other times where I had to go to school part-time. And so that took me 7 years to get out of a four-year program. But it was well worth it. And so I entered in 1977, and I graduated with my doctorate degree in clinical psychology in 1985.
Okay. And if you can, just for our listeners, if you can just tell us specifically, what is a forensic clinical psychologist?
Yes. After I got my degree in psychology, even before I got my degree in psychology, I had worked in the prison systems in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. I had worked at Walpole Prison, where I was doing group therapy with murderers and sex offenders and drug kingpins. Those were three different groups of people I was working with. Mm-hmm. And then when I came to, I moved to Virginia in 1987, 2 years after I got my doctorate degree. As soon as I got my doctorate degree, my first job was clinical director of an adolescent treatment facility, so I enjoyed that kind of work too. And then I moved to Virginia, and while I was in Virginia working at Eastern State Hospital, which just happens to be the oldest public state hospital in the country,
mm-hmm.
I took courses in forensic evaluations. Now, the school of it's in Charlottesville, Virginia, at the University of Virginia's School of Law, Psychiatry, and Public Policy. Now, that's where I learned how to do forensic evaluations. A forensic evaluation is an evaluation that helps the court decide what they should do with a defendant that might have a mental illness. And so what I do are evaluations to determine, first of all, whether or not an individual is competent to stand trial. That is, do they know enough about trial procedures to aid their attorney in mounting an adequate defense? And secondly, were they sane or insane when they committed their offense? And so basically that's what I do now as a forensic psychologist. I don't work in any prisons anymore, you know.
Okay.
What I do are forensic evaluations. So a forensic psychologist is anyone, any criminal psychologist that works with the court or the criminal justice system, either in penitentiary doing treatment or with doing evaluations.
And Dr. Williams, how did you stay a positive in that type of environment, I guess the environment in which you worked in the prisons and things of that sort? How did you remain positive? Or if you can speak specifically, what effect did it play on you?
Well, it had a lot of effect on me, you know, at various times in my career. First of all, I am an ex-felon myself. So
okay.
There are people in the prison system that I could empathize with, you know, and so it wasn't really that difficult for me to empathize with people that have kind of gone off track and made mistakes in their lives and
mm-hmm.
find themselves locked up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one perspective. Another perspective is that speaks more directly to what you're saying in terms of staying positive is the idea that I came face to face with my limits. That is, I was working at a place in Massachusetts called the Bridgewater Treatment Center for the Sexually Dangerous. And these are men that rape and kill their victims. So they're serial killers along with being rapists. And so they have a special prison for them, you know, because the work here is extremely intense. And everybody in the prison has the same sentence, a day to life, you know.
Right.
And so what I found was that I could not empathize with men that rape and sexually abuse infants.
Right.
It was just too much for me, you know. And so I had, for the first time in my life, although, you know, I figured that I could kind of deal with anybody, I had come face to face with my own limits. And so
right.
For 6 months, I had a headache every day, you know, because mm-hmm. when you're getting in this field, one of the things that kind of happens to a lot of us is we tend to over-identify with their clients. And by over-identifying, what I mean specifically is bringing your work home. You know, so I'm thinking about it all the time. And now that I have been in the head of so many sex offenders, I know how they think, you know. But I was particularly troubled by working with those that offend against infants. And so
my question, Dr. Williams, is what would be, how would you interpret a victory, or if you had a change, or if they were able to have a change of heart, or how did you influence that? What would be, how would you be able to interpret or take a small victory home? I mean, did they show remorse, or, you know, what was it to show you that what you were doing was actually having some effect on the prisoner?
Well, are you talking about in the situation of working with sex offenders, or are you talking about working with what population? Because I've worked with a lot of different populations.
But I'm asking specifically with the sex offenders.
With the sex offenders.
Yes,
well,
sir.
First of all, the attitude is, my attitude is, you know, that kind of keeps me afloat, is that the sex offender is not my client.
Mm-hmm.
My client is the community. I'm trying to keep the community safer with these we're trying to help these individuals. So with that attitude, it helps me deal with the sex offender himself or herself, because I've had female sex offenders too. And so there are some people, well, first of all, a lot of sex offenders were victims themselves. And so I have to address that issue of their own victimization. Now, the thing is that probably 90% of sex offenders were victimized, you know, but that does not mean that 90% of people that are victimized become sex offenders. So the reverse is not true, you know. And so one thing I help them do is kind of understand how they are playing out their abuse and how that relates to their victimization. For instance, I have found that oftentimes sex offenders abuse people, children, who are a similar age when they were abused. You know, so the thing is that the takeaway for me is that I help them develop some insight into why they do what they do, which is why I originally got into this field, to help people understand what they do and why they do it. So that's my
And with
takeaway.
That in mind, and what you mentioned earlier was that your client was the community or is the community, and that's who you're seeking to help. So can you define what that help is, or can you define help as you define it? Tell us what help is as you define it.
Well, help for me is being able to have a person understand why they do what they do,
mm-hmm.
and to develop empathy, that, you know, because a lot of them don't have empathy for their victims, you know,
mm-hmm.
and looking at it from a relapse prevention point of view. Now,
mm-hmm.
what that means, that is a style of treatment for sex offenders, because when you're dealing with sex offenders, you're not really doing psychotherapy. What you're really doing, unless you're dealing with the part where they were victimized themselves. But the majority of the treatment is really what we call psychoeducational. You know, that is, I help them understand what their offense cycle is. When are they most at risk of reoffending? You know, I mean, because sex offenders don't just go out and just randomly do things like abusing people. You know, what they do is they go through a particular cycle, which may involve them feeling depressed or angry or rejected, you know, and then they act on those feelings. That's the kind of help that I'm able to give.
Okay. And Now I wanted to get in more into some of the things you are currently doing, and I was looking over your bio, and I looked at the book that you have coming out, Bridging the Gap, and I just was interested. I wanted to know how did the scriptures and Christianity, how did this come into play with, you know, this particular area of your life, meaning psychology or psychoanalyzing. I'm sorry.
So the question is, how did I merge spirituality with psychotherapy, with psychology? Is that what you're asking me?
Yes, and how did the Christianity and the scriptures, how did these things come into this area of your life, and how did you apply them in your area of work?
Well, this was the first book that I wrote, and it was never my intention to write a book. I mean, after writing a dissertation to try to just to get the doctorate degree, a 200-page dissertation, I was not really up for doing any more research or any more writing. But
right.
While I was working at Eastern State Hospital, a situation with a client presented itself in a way that kind of facilitated the process of blending psychology with scripture. You know, I mean, because when I did it, it was back in 1987 or 88 that I first started compiling information to do this. And at that time, nobody was talking about blending the two. As a matter of fact, we were specifically taught not to include spirituality and psychotherapy together. That we, you know, that would be almost unethical thing to do. You know, so I mean, I didn't really get any encouragement from the profession, and a lot of people sort of made fun of me, said I wear my spirituality on my sleeve. I remember one person saying that, you know, but that's just
now
the way
I am. Why was it seen as unethical, Dr. Williams?
Because when you include spirituality, which is sometimes closely related to religion, you know, there is the fear that you are imposing your beliefs on somebody else.
Okay.
And that would make it unethical to do.
Okay.
You know. So that was the main reason. But what happened to me was, and I write about this in the book, Psychology from Scripture, in the first chapter about how I got into it, I met a woman that was in the hospital. She was a middle-aged white female, and she had been in and out of a hospital for 10 years. And what would happen is she would start having auditory and visual hallucinations, decompensate, and become psychotic, and end up being hospitalized. And so she wasn't assigned to me, you know, but it was a slow day at Eastern State. And so I said to her, I invited her into my office. I said, I'd like to talk to you. She said, oh, okay, fine. So she came into my office, and her history is such that from her wrist to her elbow was a mass of scar tissue where she was self-abusing by cutting herself over the past 10 years. And so I asked her a question that she said no one had ever asked her in the 10 years she had been in and out of Eastern State Hospital. The question was, why do you do that? No one had ever asked her that. And so she said that I cut myself because I have visions of Moses asking for blood. I said, oh, okay, all right. And what I was doing was I was not trying to, you know, necessarily say, oh, that's crazy. You know, I was trying to understand, you know, how she would get to that point. And I had what I like to call an epiphany. An epiphany being a time in your life where thoughts and ideas come together and you finally get it. Light comes on. Or you may be surprised by some of the wisdom that will come out of your mouth. That type of epiphany. And so I said to her, and this session lasted about 2 hours. I only had this one session with her. And I said, well, has it ever occurred to you that, and the other thing is that I am raised Catholic, You know, so I went to Catholic schools all my life, and when you go to Catholic schools, the most important subject you take is religion. I mean, you can pass anything else. If you fail religion, you repeat the grade. You know, I mean, that's just the way. I don't know if you know anything about parochial schools, but that's the way they operate, at least when I was there.
Okay.
So I had a lot of background with spirituality and religion and stuff like that because I had been to Catholic schools, you know, from the fifth grade up through the 12th grade. And so I said to her, has it ever occurred to you that the death and suffering of Jesus Christ ended blood sacrifice? And so, you know, we talked about that for maybe a half an hour, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And she got to the point where, okay, yeah, well, maybe. So I said, well, now, if that is true, then is it further possible that the visions that you have are that of an imposter? We talked about that for another half an hour. And she finally agreed that, yeah, I guess so. I said, well, now, if the visions you have are that of an imposter, who would it be? And we agreed that it was a demon. And that's how I got started, putting religion and psychology together. The other thing was that I was doing group therapy with schizophrenics that were about to be discharged. And during that group therapy, I used Proverbs, because to me, Proverbs is a very good book of the Bible that has just general ideas of how you should live your life.
Right.
You know, what you need to do, you know, how to deal with women, how to deal with temptation, how to deal with other people, how to deal with friendship, you know, you know, and it gives you some wisdom. So I was using the book of Proverbs with my schizophrenic group. And I might add that, well, first of all, no one bothered me. You know, they let me, my supervisor knew what I was doing, and she let me do it. You know, she didn't have any problem with it. And the patients loved it. They absolutely loved it. You know, so I guess those two things are how I began putting psychology and scripture together. But for me, and my own personal belief system is such that I had always put it together with everything I was doing, you know, whether I was doing plumbing or whatever. You know, because for me, you know, whatever I'm doing, if it's not consistent with my spiritual beliefs, I probably don't need to be doing it.
Right. And just listening to your story, I believe that the truth always has a way of being effective, especially on those in which the truth is being applied to. And I guess I want to know, how are you continuing to do the same thing today? Are you still doing the same thing within your practice?
I don't have a therapy practice anymore.
Okay.
The only practice I have is my forensic practice, where I'm doing evaluation on defendants for competency to stand trial and sanity at the time of offense. So I don't have a therapy practice.
Okay.
However, what I do is I do go around to churches and I do seminars, you know, my book, because my book has four chapters. The first chapter talks about the relationship between spiritual warfare and mental illness. The second chapter deals with the relationship between the mind and soul. The third chapter deals with, and this is the one that is the most favorite one that I like to hear at Hampton University, where I'm a professor, is about relationships. How to tell the difference between a short-term recreational relationship and a long-term marriage relationship. And the fourth chapter. That's it.
If you could just repeat those chapters again, because you went in and out, I'm sorry. If you could just repeat those chapters again for us.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir, I hear you.
Okay. The first chapter deals with the relationship between spiritual warfare
right.
and mental illness.
Uh-huh.
The second chapter deals with the relationship between the mind and the soul.
Okay.
The third chapter deals with relationships, how to tell the difference between a short-term recreational relationship and a long-term marriage relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And the fourth chapter is spiritual relaxation.
Great, great, great. And do you have, I guess, in your speaking engagements and in applying your work, are there any success stories that, what was your most, or your fondest success story? And then has there ever been any moments where, you know, maybe things did not go or work out the way you'd like, you would have liked them to work out?
Well, I mean, my favorite success story really didn't have anything to do with spirituality.
Okay.
You know, I mean, that was a different thing. I guess
I'm wondering, in applying the spirituality, in applying the spirituality to your psychology, what is your most fondest success story within that realm, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well, within that realm, I would say that mostly watching miracles.
Mm. If you can elaborate on that for us.
Well, I was the last place that I worked doing psychotherapy was a place in Virginia Beach called Christian Psychotherapy Services, which was great, you know, because then I was allowed to actually pray with my clients if they wanted to pray.
Mm-hmm.
And so while I was there, I would oftentimes ask my clients if they would like to pray while, you know, at the beginning of our session, at the end of our session, the middle of a session, or for the whole session. It didn't matter to me, you know, because my attitude was this. It does not make sense to leave your strengths at home while working on your weaknesses.
Uh-huh.
You need to bring your strengths with you.
Uh-huh.
And so I would say that, you know, and I would have clients with all kinds of different disorders, children with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, bipolar disorder, and physical disorders, you know. And I would say that if I prayed, for every 10 people I prayed for, I saw them cured in my office. I saw at least one person cured in my office.
Mm.
Whatever their problem was.
Okay.
Yes. And that was a really beautiful thing, you know. And I must say, to God be the glory, because I tell people that I don't cure anyone. My job is not to cure anyone as a therapist. My job is to remove some of the emotional baggage and garbage that you have, you know, that is blocking God's blessings for you. And that's the way I typify, you know, what I do. You know, so that would be.
And Dr. Williams, if you can tell us, Dr. Williams, how would you know, I guess, for that one out of every 10 that was cured in your office, how would you know that they were cured? What was the breakthrough, or what was the sign that they had been cured? What did
their
you admission or?
Their parents would tell me. I had one particular boy that, and I think this boy was being raised by his stepmother,
mm-hmm.
Not his stepmother, but by his grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
And he had, he was diagnosed with ADHD, that's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, along with childhood bipolar disorder. And he was on all types of medication. And I asked him if they would like, you know, me to pray for him. And she said yes. And she had been bringing him in to see me probably about 10 times. You know, because you know, I don't always just kind of spring the praying thing right away. You know, after I had tried a lot of psychotherapy and psychological interventions that were not working, you know, then I went to prayer. And so I did this for the boy, and the reverend said he was cured. You know, So usually it'll be parents that will tell me that you know, when I'm working with a child, you know, that their child is cured. You know, now with adults, I had a woman that came to see me, and she was depressed and anxious, and she had, among other things, multiple sclerosis. You know, mm-hmm. And she had some sort of sensitivity to daylight, and so she always wore these heavy glasses, and she had constant headaches.
Mm-hmm.
And so I prayed for her. She said, yeah, you can pray for me. I prayed for her, and she was cured in my office the first time I prayed. And of course, I'm learning as I go along. And she left, and she came back the following week because we were meeting once a week. And she said, Dr. Williams, you know, everything was fine, you know, for a couple of days, and then all my symptoms came back, you know. And I said, oh, I'm sorry. What I didn't do is I didn't teach you how to maintain your blessing. So then I did all the praying again. She was cured again. And this time I taught her how to maintain her blessing, and she was fine.
Oh, okay. Great. And if you can, is there a particular story in which maybe things did not go your way, or you know, maybe things didn't go the way you planned? Is there a particular story in that regard?
Well, I don't have a particular story.
Okay.
And you know, because I've never been in a situation where everything just went wrong.
Right. Okay. Great.
You know,
great.
There were just various degrees of things going right. Sometimes things
I like
went
that.
Way right, and sometimes things went a little right. And sometimes
like
people just walk out. I mean, because, you know, I have clients that didn't get anything out of psychotherapy and didn't want to be paid for, you know, and I can accept that. So I don't really take that as a loss, you know.
Okay.
You know, I understand, for instance, that psychotherapy is not a panacea. It doesn't work for everybody, you know. There's no one thing that has ever been known to work for everybody. Even when Jesus Christ was there, that didn't work for everybody.
Right.
If Jesus Christ didn't work for everybody, who am I to expect to have something that's going to work for everybody?
Mm-hmm.
I just let it go. It don't work, that's fine. Next.
Great. I see your point. I think that's an interesting and positive way to look at things. How do your peers see you, those who are also in the field? How are you treated and how are you seen by your peers? Do they ever ask you for help, or do they ask you for, you know, being that you seem to have been one of the trailblazers of this movement or this particular type of psychology to take place, merging the scriptures with psychology? I mean, are you often asked for help? Are you also you know, to help others with this, or I know you're in demand to speak, but how are you seen by your peers?
Well, I don't talk about it with them.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't talk about stuff. You know, I mean, when you are a psychotherapist, most oftentimes you are self-employed. You know, you're kind of they're in an office, someone else's office, and they're doing the marketing and they're getting the clients, and you're self-employed and you work all the hours you want to work and stuff like that. And I've noticed that we psychotherapists don't kind of get together, you know, like maybe other professions do, you know, and go for a drink or just go talk a little bit, you know. So we really don't do that sort of thing. So
okay.
Really discuss it much with other therapists.
Right. Okay. And now we want to move into and talk briefly with you about your upcoming book, Roxbury Redemption. If you could, what are you hoping that the reader will get out of this book?
Encouragement. If I had to put it in a word, it would be encouragement.
Mm-hmm.
What I did was I wrote a book that started off as an autobiography, you know. And actually, I had been telling parts of my life story in the classroom at Hampton University. See, I've been teaching there for 6 years now.
Okay.
And you know, every now and then I tell them a little, give them a little snippet of things that I've done and the fact that I was in prison or some of the things that I did to get in prison. You know, and they would think it was fascinating. They were just fascinated by it. I didn't think it was that big a deal, you know. And, you know, I mean, you know, other times people would be fascinated by just the things I've done in my life. You know, I mean, you know, I've been to school for aeronautics and space engineering, the College of Pharmacy. I've been to school as a physics major. I've been a stockbroker trainee. I've been a plumber for 20 years. I've been a tractor trailer driver. All kinds of stuff that I've done in my life. You know, I mean, I've had a really good life. You know,
mm-hmm.
And so they would be fascinated by it, and they should say, "Oh, Dwayne, you should write a book." You know, and so people told me that for a bunch of years. I said, well, maybe I'll put a little something on paper. You know, but my idea of putting something on paper was really for the benefit of my family, my children. I have a wife, a son, and a daughter. And so that they would know a little something about their father and how my life was, you know. But then, after I got to writing it, you know, I had a different perspective, you know, because the guy that was my boss at one of the places I worked said, would always make the comment, he said, you know, you're like the poster, you should be the poster child for reform, you know. You ought to write about, you know, how to go straight, how to get your life together. And so the book is in parts. First part is my life, my autobiography, all my ups and downs and my ins and outs and my triumphs and my failures. And then the second half of the book are interventions that I used to keep myself straight, you know, that I have now been able to conceptualize now that I'm a psychologist. So that's what the book is.
Great, great. And what was the one thing, I guess, that made you say to yourself, this is something that I have to do as far as psychology and bridging the gap between the scriptures and psychology? What was that one instance where you said, hey, this is what I'm supposed to do, or this is what I have to do? What was it that made that click into your mind?
Usually other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because with the first book, it didn't just come out as a book. I just wrote that first chapter about the relationship between spiritual warfare and mental illness. And at first I just recorded it on a tape. And I would give copies of that tape to various clients that I thought use it. Then someone asked me to do a seminar, you know, and that seminar ended up being about the relationship between the mind and the soul, you know. And so I had that paper laying around for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Then when it came to writing the chapter on relationships, how to tell the difference between a short-term recreational relationship and a long-term marriage relationship, really, that came from a letter I was writing my daughter because when she first left home to go to college, you know, so that she had some idea of how to deal with relationships. And then it was a while after that, maybe a couple of years after that, that someone said, hey, you've got a book. Because I didn't even realize it. Because writing a book is not what I was trying to do, you know.
Right.
So usually my impetus and motivation for doing this is by someone else saying something to me, like I want to. You know, it's really not original. It's not original to me. You know, I can just go one day and say, you know, I'd like to write a book on psychology and scripture. It didn't happen.
Right.
Or I'm going to write my life story. You know, it has never been that. It's always been at the urging of someone else.
Right.
So, I can only take credit for actually doing it, but not starting it.
I understand. And you mentioned that you've been teaching at Hampton University for the last 6 years. So I was wondering, is there a particular story that I guess is a particular favorite amongst your students, or a story that seems to be or that has fascinated your student each and every time you've told a particular story?
Well, I think that what they find most fascinating are all the different jobs I've had in my life. You know, they're like that. And the fact that I was in prison, you know, and what I was in prison for, you know. And so they find that, you know, pretty fascinating.
Okay. And that's a story that you don't mind sharing with your students, I see.
No, I don't care.
Great.
Who I am.
Right. And that's a great attitude to have. I just know that there are a lot of people who, you know, for the most part, try not to have their past, you know, come out into the forefront. But I think it's very admirable that you acknowledge that your past has had definitely an influence on who you are even to this day. My last question for you, Dr. Williams, is are there any patients or students or anybody that you know of that is planning to do or follow in your footsteps or walk a similar path to you? Have you come across anybody who has said to you they want to do, you know, the same thing or something similar to what you are doing?
Well, I have certainly had a lot of students that have said that, you know, they want to be a forensic psychologist because they've taken my classes in forensic psychology.
Great.
I have certainly, I just started a new course, which, matter of fact, they didn't have forensic psychology until I got there to Hampton University. They didn't have that. I'm teaching another course that they've never had there, and that's sports psychology.
Okay.
You know, so I have people that are saying that, you know, they want to be a sports psychologist because, you know, they like the way I teach it, or they like the way I talk about it, or something like that. So, and you know, in my position, I write a lot of letters of recommendation for people and get them into graduate school. And a lot of them I have one student that joined the FBI, you know, and the FBI is something that I do here, you know, because I'm here in Virginia, so the FBI Academy is in Virginia. So I used to take my forensic psychology class on tours of the FBI Academy, and one of my students became an FBI agent. Other students of mine have become lawyers, you know, and doctors.
Great. Well, it's definitely clear that you had an influence on a lot of and a number of your students. Last question for real, and this is a question I guess I just want to know. Does your job, is it similar, does it relate to what we see on the TV shows, for instance, the forensic TV shows, for instance?
A lot of people ask me that. No.
Okay.
Because.
So there's definitely. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
You know. A forensic psychologist does not catch criminals.
Mm-hmm.
We do not go to the crime scene. Mm-hmm. We do not gather evidence. We don't do any of those things. The only thing we do is we interview defendants.
Okay.
What they do on television a lot of times is they will blend forensic psychology with forensic science.
Okay.
And those are two different professions. Forensic science is about going to the crime scene, you know, and gathering evidence. You know, but forensic psychology is about interviewing and evaluating defendants.
Okay. And have you heard of this movie, Primal Fear, this movie that's come out, Primal Fear?
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay. I know it has. It speaks to forensics and things of that in that sort. So I just thought maybe it was something that you might want to check out. And you know, for my friends, they're telling me it's something I'd have to check out too. I haven't checked it out, but I know it deals with forensics and things of that sort.
Well, you know, when you do it for a living, you're not all that eager to go to the movie and see it.
I understand. I understand.
Yeah.
Well, I definitely understand, Dr. Williams. We are out of time, but again, I just wanted to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to share with us your story, the story of your life, the motivation behind your upcoming book and things of that sort. So I just wanted to take time out to just say thank you. And if you can, is there any way that our listeners, if they could or if they wanted to get in touch with you, that they could get in touch with you?
Sure. You can get in touch with me through my website. And, you know, it's really a wonderful thing. I had a mother who saw a friend that had, in New Jersey, that saw a friend that had my book, get the telephone, find out my website, go to my website, do some research on who I am, and then ask me to give treatment to her, some counseling to her daughter that's down here in Norfolk going to college. Anyway, www. DrEarle.com, and that's DrEarle.com. It's my
thank you.
And anyone can get in contact with me that way.
Thank you very much for that, Dr. Earle. We appreciate you again for taking out a moment of your time to share with us your story, your inspiration, and the work that you're doing. For those listeners, this has been the Gist of Freedom. We thank you, and until next time, God bless.
Thank you. Good night.
No weapon formed against me shall prosper.